All right, well, I mean, there's a sense in which, I think I said this last time when Jerry Root gave his C.S. Lewis talk, that it almost feels like we don't need to introduce our speaker. At least the Wheaton community knows Wayne Martindale very well, but some of you may actually not know too much about him, so let me just give a brief introduction to him. So Wayne is Emeritus Professor of English at Wheaton College. He taught here in what seems like forever, and many college faculty members have done exactly that, been here 30, 40, 50 years and beyond. He got his BA in English at California Baptist College. It's now California Baptist University. They've also expanded and grown. They're doing great things out on the West Coast. Then he did his MA and PhD in English at the University of California, Riverside. Wayne's work, for the most part, focuses very much on C.S. Lewis, and he's written extensively on Lewis, many articles. One book that I want to draw your attention to that he has published is called Beyond the Shadowlands, C.S. Lewis on Heaven and Hell. It's published with Crossway. So if you like what you hear from Wayne tonight, that's a book that I can recommend that you can go and explore more about C.S. Lewis. A couple of fun facts about Wayne. One is, and this some of you may not know, he has very deep interests revolving around China. He has taught in China, he's visited China several times, he's even published on China. So if you have China questions after we get finished with Wayne in the Q&A, you can ask him about that as well. And it's also the case that Wayne has been known to hang out in science classes at Wheaton College. He came and did the full course of a class called Theories of Origins that I and some others team teach. He's had, I don't know if I would say if it's a lifelong interest, but he's had a very long interest in science. And I think you'll see tonight as he's talking about C.S. Lewis and the case against evolution, that Wayne's interest in science gives him the opportunity and the ability with his literary training to be able to pull out for us in a number of Lewis's works, a lot that we can take to understand about evolution, evolutionism, and that whole mess. So without further ado, I want to introduce Wayne Martindale.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Your president asked me to speak on something in the area of C.S. Lewis and science or nature. I decided on the case against evolutionism after a chat with Jerry Root, who spoke to you on the topic in your last meeting, C.S. Lewis and the case against scientism. It seemed like a logical follow-on. It also gave me the opportunity to test with further study the impression I had about Lewis on evolution for many years. Often students who would choose to write on the subject and had read only a little Lewis would, in my view, get it wrong. So before I delve into this, you may well have two prior questions. One is, what am I, a professor of English, doing addressing a meeting of the American Scientific Affiliation? And the related question is, what does C.S. Lewis, a literary man, have to say that a scientist would possibly need to hear? The answer to the first question is easy. I was asked. To that, I concede the possibility that one or both of us had a lapse in judgment. As to the second, certainly Lewis claimed no scientific credentials. He also claimed no theological credentials, but virtually every evangelical theologian in the universe quotes from him on theological topics. Yet, by John West's tally, Lewis explored, quoting a little bit, science and its cultural impact in 9 books nearly 30 essays, several poems, and I would add to West Tally quite a number of letters. The books by Lewis in this tally deal mostly with philosophical and cultural angles on the scientific enterprise, and it would include things like The Abolition of Man, The Discarded Image, which deals with the medieval worldview, The Problem of Pain, Mere Christianity, and these works of fiction, the science fiction trilogy, talk a bit more about those later, and works like The Magician's Nephew in The Chronicles of Narnia. Further, a significant number of books on Lewis and science have appeared. I'll cite a few of these. They include The Restitution of Man, C.S. Lewis and the Case Against Scientism, which is the work from which Jerry took his title for the last lecture, Narnia and the Fields of Arbol, The Environmental Vision of C.S. Lewis. That's University of Kentucky Press. C.S. Lewis on the Final Frontier, Science and the Supernatural in the Space Trilogy. That's an Oxford University Press release. The Magician's Twin, C.S. Lewis on Science, Scientism, and Society. We're getting down from to the more recent things, that's 2012, and then just 2016, C.S. Lewis, Anti-Darwinist. It turns out that Lewis has a great deal to say about evolution regarding the big picture, worldview or philosophical or cultural issues. I would further add this word on Lewis's qualifications, that when it comes to questions of meaning, he is rigorously trained and refined by decades of debate and disciplined thought. Lewis achieved first-class degrees in three areas of study at Oxford. One first-class degree is by itself a magnificent achievement. I think the closest an American institution would come to this is SUMA. To get three is exceedingly rare. One of his degrees, generally considered the hardest at Oxford, has a rather arcane title, Honors School of Literae Humaniores, or Greats for short. The degree hinges entirely on exams at the end. Here's a description from his biographer, George Sayer, former student turned friend and fellow scholar. The exam for greats lasted 6 days, and on each day, students wrote 2 3-hour papers. The subjects were as follows. This will make you weak in the knees. I just want to sit down and read this. Roman history, Greek unseen translation, philosophical books, translation from Roman historical texts, translation from Greek texts, translation from Plato and Aristotle, logic, general ancient history, Latin prose, moral and political philosophy. That's 36 hours of exams in 6 days. For the rest of this talk, I have 3 points I will put as questions. First, what did Lewis mean by the term evolutionism, and why was he so vigorously opposed to it? I will spend most of my time on this one. The second question is about Lewis, the diversity of opinion on Lewis and what he believed in evolution. So my question is, why is it so difficult to figure out Lewis's view? Or put another way, since he thought a lot was at stake in what view we hold, why didn't he make his own views more obvious? I want to say something on this point right up front. One of the challenges for a person who moved from being an avowed atheist to being in Walter Hooper, one of his first biographers, expression the most converted man I ever met, is that Lewis's thinking changed. It changed rapidly, and it changed radically. As a young man, he gleefully accepted and advocated Freudianism and what he came to call evolutionism, and some other other isms thrown into that mix. So the issue is, in part, what did he believe when? As it turns out, it's even more complicated than that, but the when question is key. And the third point or question is, if Lewis rejected macroevolution as a view, what did he put in its place? The emphasis is how, especially in his science fiction, Lewis answers the evolutionists, showing that the Christian view not only fulfills the goals and dreams that their view would not deliver on, but gives even more than those who believe in what he calls evolutionism dared to hope for. The first point, what did Lewis mean by the term evolutionism, and why was he so vigorously opposed to it? There are several attempts to explain the big picture or ascribe meaning to the universe within academic disciplines that Lewis believes dangerously mistaken. These are usually designated an ism. Examples would be historicism, scientism, which Jerry spoke about in the last meeting, evolutionism, Freudianism, and Marxism. Each of these has two things in common. First, they extrapolate from factual data projections that attempt to give eschatological insight. They claim to offer a framework for understanding the whole universe and human life. The problem with the historicist, says Lewis, is that he tries to get from historical premises conclusions that are more than historical, conclusions metaphysical or theological. Similarly, the evolutionist tries to get from biological data and theory explanations that can only be supplied from outside the system by revelation. These would include the big why questions. Why is there something and not nothing? Why do we exist? And questions like, how should we live? Are there real, objective, moral imperatives? And where are we going? Is there an enduring purpose for human existence? The second thing the isms have in common is that they are reductionistic. As he claimed of the atheist's position, which he once espoused himself, it's too simplistic. For each ism, Lewis would say that reality is iconoclastic. It breaks our theories. And I think we can say it about our own views of theology. Reality is constantly breaking whatever idols we set up as our conception of God. Out of all the isms, the biggest category and the one he most dislikes is historicism, which he describes in an essay by that name as the belief that men can, by the use of their natural powers, discover an inner meaning in the historical process. Tracy McKenzie, who's the chair of our history department, very much likes this essay and uses it in his courses to show limitations of the historical enterprise. For example, since technology and tools have improved over time, we might jump to the conclusion that human government or ideas about meaning and even morality are also improving over time. Lewis had a term for this, he called it chronological snobbery, thinking that the latest is the best simply because it is the most current. The burden of his essay, De Futilitate, of Futility, is shown that is to show that history, especially 20th century history, demonstrates that humanity is not getting more civil and that our technology has been the undoing of multiplied millions in lives lost. Not a difficult case to make. The essay was given as an address in the midst of the Nazi campaign to purify the race by exterminating Jews and the physically and mentally weak, and by extending its political system through extreme violence. Further, the whole universe is burning itself out into a cosmic winter. With regard to humanity, it is impossible to know strictly from within history where we are in the grand scheme. Are we in Act One, or are we in Act Five? Are we protagonists? Are we a big deal, or are we bit players? Further, even if our universe is of any large-scale importance, that you also need to judge from information outside historical data. You can't use a phrase like "the judgment of history," Lewis cautions, unless you have a revelation about the meaning of humanity and of place, time and space, from beyond history. Lewis sees evolutionism as a subset of historicism, making claims from within the system about the meaning of the system itself. Now, since evolution can mean many things, let me stake out the territory a little using John West's three helpful definitions. Some of you will recognize the name John West. He's co-editor of the C.S. Lewis Reader's Encyclopedia and of a collection of essays called The Magician's Twin, which I mentioned earlier, C.S. Lewis on Science, Scientism, and Society. First, some use the term evolution to denote the theory of common descent. The second use of the term is to mean unguided natural selection acting on random variables. And the third is evolution as a cosmic philosophy. And this is the one Lewis calls evolutionism. On the first of these, common descent, Lewis is willing in some of his best-known writing to concede common descent as a possible explanation for how God prepared the physical form of humans. He didn't make an article of faith out of this either way. In fact, he says clearly that one might believe in common descent and still be a Christian. I'm sure that's a great relief. That Lewis' judgment on that. That said, he's not a big fan of the position and did hold three positions that clash with versions of this view. First, from his earliest Christian writings, Lewis held an unshakable view of the fall. He was very Augustinian, believing that God created all things good, including humanity and its environment, but that through choice, also created good, human beings and their environment fell under a curse, including death. Second, Lewis believed in a literal Adam and Eve who fell. This is demonstrable from many prose statements, like chapter 5 of the early book, The Problem of Pain. Let me quote a little in this chapter to illustrate how Lewis concedes common descent up to a point and then insists on a radical departure from natural processes. For long centuries, God perfected the animal form which was to become the vehicle of humanity and the image of himself. But it was only an animal because all of its physical and psychical processes were directed to purely material and natural ends. Then, in the fullness of time, God caused to descend upon this organism, both its psychology and physiology, a new kind of consciousness, which could say, I and me, which could look upon itself as an object, which knew God, which could make judgments of truth, beauty, and goodness, and which was so far above time that it could perceive time flowing past. This new consciousness ruled and illuminated the whole organism, flooding every part of it with light, and was not like ours, limited to a selection of the movements going on in one part of the organism, namely the brain. Man was then all consciousness. His organic processes obeyed the law of his own will, not the law of nature. Wholly commanding himself, he commanded all lower lives with which he came into contact. Even now, we meet rare individuals who have a mysterious power of taming beasts. This power, the paradisal man, enjoyed in imminence. The old picture of the brute sporting before Adam and fawning upon him may not be wholly symbolical. To his prose statements, we can add the recapitulation of the Genesis account and works like Paralandra. He wrote about the same time he was writing Paralandra, Preface to Paradise Lost, in which Milton deals with an expansive view of what it might have been like in Eden before the fall, and how what God created good might come to fall. And then there are also the Pevensey children, who are referred to as sons of Adam and daughters of Eve. And third, Lewis didn't believe that a mindless process could produce mind. So we've been considering Lewis's views on the term evolution as meaning common descent. The second and third kinds of evolution he rejected early and became only stronger in his opposition. The second, unguided natural selection acting on variables, Lewis rejected about 4 years before becoming a Christian. While Lewis was still about 20 and recovering from shrapnel wounds he received in the First World War, 4 years before becoming a Christian, he picked up a book by Henry Bergson called Creative Evolution. Lewis would later critique Bergson's position too, but for now, it persuaded him that Darwinian selection could not account for the creative process that resulted in something as complex as a human being. Lewis wrote to his father in 1925, "It will be a comfort to me all my life to know that the scientist and the materialist have not the last word, that Darwin and Spencer undermining ancestral beliefs stand themselves on a foundation of sand, of gigantic assumptions and irreconcilable contradictions an inch below the surface." Bergson's book and other big anti-evolutionary influences were part of Lewis's conversion process, which he recounts in his spiritual autobiography, Surprised by Joy. The other two major critiques were G.K. Chesterton's The Everlasting Man, which he read around 1925, and Sir Arthur Balfour's Theism and Humanism, which he may have read earlier than his first mention of him in a 1940s lecture. Both of these books appear on a list of 10 books Lewis cited toward the end of his life as being the 10 most influential books on the shape of his philosophy of life and his vocation. But it was the third definition of the term evolution that Lewis came to see as not only false but dangerous. To distinguish it from other uses, he calls it evolutionism. There are several places where Lewis defines the term. You already get the drift, I'm sure. A good place to nail down the definition is an essay called The Funeral of a Great Myth, which is one of several essays pertinent to this topic in the collection called Christian Reflections. The great myth he refers to is evolutionism. Sometimes he calls it other names like the myth of progress. Here's a quotation from The Funeral of a Great Myth. In the science, evolution is a theory about changes. In the myth, it is a fact about improvements, presented as a fact about improvements, he means. Thus, a real scientist like Professor J.B.S. Haldane is at pains to point out that popular ideas of evolution lay a wholly unjustified emphasis on changes which have rendered creatures, by human standards, better or more interesting. He adds, quoting Haldane, "We are therefore inclined to regard progress as the rule in evolution. Actually, it is the exception, and for every case of it, there are 10 of degeneration." It's Lewis's quote of Haldane. Now continuing Lewis's words, "But the myth simply expurgates the 10 cases of degeneration. In the popular mind, the word evolution conjures up a picture of things moving onwards and upwards, and of nothing else whatsoever. And it might have been predicted that it would do so. Already before science had spoken, the mythical imagination knew the kind of evolution it wanted. It wanted the Keatsian and Wagnerian kind, the gods superseding the Titans, and the young, joyous, treaty-entangled Wotan. If science offers any instances to satisfy that demand, they will be eagerly accepted. If it offers any instances that frustrate it, they will simply be ignored." I think it is no small thing in this discussion to remember that long before he became a critic of evolutionism, Lewis believed in it himself. In the very essay in which Lewis aims to bury the evolutionary meta-narrative, he readily accedes that it has great imaginative appeal to him. "I grew up believing in the myth and have felt, I still feel it, its almost perfect grandeur. Let no one say we are in unimaginative age. Neither the Greeks nor the Norsemen ever invented a better story. Even to the present day, in certain moods, I could almost find it in my heart to wish that it was not mythical, but true. And yet, how could it be?" He thought the story of the universe arising from almost zero to the status of almost infinity and collapsing again into total extinction better than any Elizabethan tragedy. But he rejected the myth on two primary grounds. One is the existence of the moral law. This Lewis develops in several places, including the opening chapters of Mere Christianity and in The Abolition of Man. The other, which he has in view here and in essays like, is theology. Poetry is the existence of reason. The Darwinian hypothesis and the whole myth of progress that precedes him is based on reason and inference. If reason is the product of random and mindless chance and not something bigger than nature, how could we trust it to give a true picture of the nature in which it is embedded? Lewis argues, unless you start by believing that reality in the remotest space and the remotest time rigidly obeys the laws of logic, you can have no ground for believing in any astronomy, any biology, any paleontology, any archaeology. You can't prove that proofs are irrational and at the same time make logical inferences about evidence for evolutionism. It is self-contradictory. The fact that so many have difficulty seeing the case in these terms, says Lewis, confirms one's suspicion that here we touch a radical disease in their whole style of thought. Here's what Lewis means by the phrase, their whole style of thought. Having first turned what was a theory of change into a theory of improvement, it then makes this a cosmic theory. Not merely terrestrial organisms, but everything is moving upwards and onwards. Reason has evolved out of instinct, virtue out of complexes, poetry out of erotic howls and grunts, civilization out of savagery, the organic out of inorganic, the solar system out of some sidereal soup or traffic block. This is still quoting Lewis. And conversely, reason, virtue, art, and civilization, as we now know them, are only the crude or embryonic beginnings of better things, perhaps deity itself in the remote future. For in the myth, evolution, as the myth understands it, is the formula for all existence. To exist means to be moving from the status of almost zero to almost infinity. To those brought up on the myth, nothing seems more normal, more natural, more plausible than that chaos should turn into order, death into life, ignorance into knowledge, and with this we reach the full-blown myth. It is one of the most moving and satisfying world dramas which have ever been imagined. End quote from Lewis. To make the case for Lewis as a large-scale evolutionist, you have to selectively quote from books like The Problem of Pain or Mere Christianity, leaving out Lewis's numerous caveats, like the lead-in to the account of possible animal ancestry to account for the development of a human body. Lewis begins by saying, what exactly happened when man fell, we do not know. But if it is legitimate to guess, I offer the following picture, a myth in the Socratic sense of not an unlikely tale. And remember that the account gives a view of Adam, God brought into being as sinless and perfectly in tune with God's will and his environment. Something from outside came into the created order. Throughout his Christian life, which was the last half of it, Lewis argued strenuously against naturalism and for creation ex nihilo, especially on the grounds of our capacity for reason. If reason were the product of irrational forces without purposiveness, the rational ground for Darwinian or any other kind of argument was lacking. Some of you may remember C. Stephen Evans, who was in Wheaton's philosophy department before he headed to Baylor University. In reviewing Victor Rupert's book, C.S. Lewis's Dangerous Idea, Evans writes, Darwinists try to show through science that our world and its inhabitants can be fully explained as the product of a mindless, purposeless system of physics and chemistry. Evans writes, Lewis demonstrated that the Darwinian argument was circular. If such materialism or naturalism were true, then scientific reasoning itself could not be trusted. Contrary to the dismissals of hasty critics, the basic thrust of Lewis's argument from reason can bear up under the weight of the most serious philosophical attacks. It's from C. Stephen Evans, no mean philosopher himself. Now I want to look at two other sources for Lewis's later views on evolutionism. They are nowhere near as well known, but are very telling. Part of the richness in reading Lewis is that you get multiple themes in several different genres, so that if, philosophy or theology is your bent, then you can read apologetics works, either book length or essay. If fiction or poetry is your bent, then you can often find it there as well. And since Lewis spent one or two hours every day of his life for the last half, it's not surprising that you would write in letters, that you'll find something on your theme of interest in the letters. Not difficult to do since Walter Hooper's 3-volume, several thousand page collected letters of C.S. Lewis, which has a magnificent index. Letters first. I want to look especially at a few excerpts from Lewis's 16-year correspondence with Bernard Ackworth, founder and president emeritus of the British Evolution Protest Movement. That's the name of the organization. In digging for this talk, I found that G.B. Ferngren and Ronald Numbers published in the American Scientific Affiliation Journal for 1996 a piece called C.S. Lewis on Creation and Evolution, subtitled The Ackworth Letters, 1944 to 1960. It's in volume 49. Bernard Ackworth, founder and president emeritus of the British Evolution Protest Movement, had sent Lewis a copy of his book called This Progress, subtitled The Tragedy of Evolution, which Lewis refers to by the keyword evolution in the following excerpt from a letter he wrote to Ackworth. This is 13 December 1951. Dear Ackworth, I have read nearly the whole of Evolution, his book, and am glad you sent it. I must confess, it has shaken me, not in my belief in evolution, which was of the vaguest and most intermittent kind, but in my belief that the question was wholly unimportant. I wish I was younger. What inclines me now to think that you might be right in regarding this evolution, the central and radical lie in the whole web of falsehood that now governs our lives, is not so much your arguments against it as the fanatical and twisted attitudes of its defenders. The section on anthropology was especially good. The point that the whole economy of nature depends simultaneously on a good many species is a very strong one. Thanks and blessings, yours, C.S. Lewis. In another letter to Ackworth several years later, Lewis writes, I'm most interested to hear of your young biologist, and his experience impresses one again with the suspicious disingenuousness of orthodox biologists. I'll come back to Ackworth briefly one more time in the next section. The final illustration of the big point, first big point, what Lewis meant by evolutionism, comes from his poems. The poems on this theme employ satire. They work by making a position look laughable or foolish. Those that have a date come from the 1950s. That means about the last decade of Lewis's life. I'll read only one example, and there are some that are even more acerbic than this example, using even for a major controlling conceit, rape, as he describes human beings' efforts to invade space and corrupt it with their own fallenness. But this one is called Evolutionary Hymn. It was first published in 1957. Lead us, evolution, lead us up the future's endless stair. Chop us, change us, prod us, weed us, for stagnation is despair. groping, guessing, yet progressing, lead us nobody knows where. Wrong or justice in the present, joy or sorrow, what are they? While there's always jam tomorrow, while we tread the onward way. Never knowing where we're going, we can never go astray. To whatever variation our posterity may turn, hairy, squashy, or crustacean, bulbous eyes, or square of stern, tusked or toothless, mild or ruthless, toward that unknown God we yearn. Ask not if it's God or devil, brethren, lest your words imply static norms of good and evil, as in Plato, throned on high. Such scholastic, inelastic, abstract yardsticks we deny. Far too long have sages vainly glossed great nature's simple text. He who runs can plainly read it. Goodness equals what comes next. By evolving, life is solving all the questions we perplexed. On then, value means survival value. If our progeny spreads and spawns and licks each rival, that will prove its deity. Far from pleasant by our present standard, though it well may be. That's his poem, Evolutionary Hymn. Very tongue-in-cheek, very acerbic, maybe very over the top. What did Lewis think was at stake in the debate over what he calls evolutionism? In his talk to Oxford students during the Second World War, he was responding to a widespread sense of futility, especially since the First World War, which was hoped by many to end all wars. It was so terrible, who could even fathom having another war on this magnitude? It was out of bounds even for the imagination. But such was the case. They were in the midst of another world war. Lewis called the address De Futilitate, Latin for of futility. And Lewis characteristically puts the issue in a larger context. If our hope is only for this world, why shouldn't we be forever despairing, not just over the Second World War, but over everything? The only reason we are not despairing about the whole end of the universe, which is running down, is our belief in the myth of progress. Lewis says, this cosmic futility is concealed from the masses by popular evolutionism. Speaking to a scientifically trained audience, I need not labor the point that popular evolutionism is something quite different from evolution as the biologists understand it. Biological evolution is about how organisms change. Some of these changes have made organisms, judged by human standards, better, more flexible, stronger, more conscious. The majority of changes have not done so. He cites J.B.S. Haldane again. In evolution, progress is the exception and degeneration the rule. Popular evolutionism ignores this. As Lewis puts it in another essay, The Funeral of a Great Myth, in the science, evolution is a theory about changes. In the myth, it is a fact about improvements. Real science, Lewis believed, as in the second law of thermodynamics, teaches cosmic degradation. On the second point, my first main point was a question, by far longest treatment, what does Lewis mean by evolution? Why does he reject it? And the main grounds are that it doesn't account for rationalism or for morality. My second main question is, why is it so difficult to figure out Lewis's view? One of the reasons for the difficulty I've already suggested, he didn't stay put in his thinking. You always have to ask the when question. But since he thought a lot was at stake, why didn't he make his views more obvious? There are two challenges. One, he sometimes grants part of the evolutionary view to use it as an illustration of something bigger in Christianity. And second, he did not want to make it a watershed issue. An example of the first challenge is that Lewis uses evolution to illustrate new life in Christ. This is the opening paragraph of the last chapter of Mere Christianity. The chapter is entitled The New Men. In the last chapter, I compared Christ's work of making new men to the process of turning a horse into a winged creature. I use that extreme example in order to emphasize the point that it is not mere improvement, but, and he capitalizes it, transformation. The nearest parallel to it in the world of nature is to be found in the remarkable transformations we can make in insects by applying certain rays to them. Some people think this is the way evolution worked. The alterations in creatures on which it all, the alterations in creatures on which it all depends may have been produced by rays coming from outer space. Of course, once the alterations are there, what they call natural selection gets to work on them, i.e. the useful alterations survive and the other ones get weeded out. It's the end of that quote from the paragraph in Mere Christianity. So if Lewis is willing to concede the point, to make a larger point about Christianity, then does he not accept it? That's the inference that often gets made. To the second big challenge, then, taken together, the two essays, the poem and the correspondence, make a strong case for Lewis's anti-Darwinism, and yet, as it turns out, the essays were published posthumously, the poem was published anonymously, and the private correspondence was not published until well after his death. If Lewis harbored such grave doubts about Darwinism and evolutionism, why was he not more public about it? Most importantly, he didn't want to deflect attention from his arguments for mere Christianity. As he says in a much later letter to Bernard Ackworth, "Dear Ackworth, no, I'm afraid I should lose much, and you would gain almost nothing by my writing you a preface. No one who is in doubt about your view on Darwin would be impressed by testimony from me, and who am known to be no scientist. Many who have been or are being moved toward Christianity by my books would be deterred by finding that I was connected with anti-Darwinism. I hope, but who knows himself, that I would not allow myself to be influenced by this consideration if it were only my personal success as an author that was endangered. But the cause I stand for would be endangered too. When a man has become a popular apologist, he must watch his step. Everyone is on the lookout for things that might discredit him. Sorry, yours, C.S. Lewis." So, the third point I will just hint at, it's time to stop. It is, if Lewis rejected the macroevolutionary view, what did he put in its place? There are a lot of places we can look, but the fiction is the best place for this. Lewis answers the evolutionists, and when he uses the term evolutionists with IST, he means those who believe in evolutionism, as he defined it, showing that the Christian view not only fulfills the goals and dreams that their view will not deliver on, but gives even more than they hope to dare for. So this, of course, is in Mere Christianity as well, where he talks about the transformation wrought by Christ in fulfilling our potential in the new birth. But it's really huge in his fiction, especially the science fiction trilogy. Or as our incoming director of the Wade Center likes to refer to these books, the Ransom Trilogy, since they're not all set in space. The three books are Out of the Silent Planet, which he wrote in 1938, Paralandra, 1943, and That Hideous Strength, 1945. The plots and themes of these books hinge on evolutionary issues. In the first of these, the antagonists are Weston, who's a physicist and a dedicated Darwinian of the H.G. Wells stripe. And the second antagonist, ironically named Divine, funds the project and is along for purely materialistic gain by exploiting, he hopes, potential resources of other planets. In our era, he would typify the person who is interested in planetary exploration to harvest rare earths for electronic components. These men abduct a Lewis-like character named Ransom. His name suggests he's going to be the savior of these planets. He voyages to Mars, and then he voyages to Paralandra. The last book is set on Earth in a university setting. Their only reason in taking Ransom is that they believe the inhabitants of the planet they call Malachondra or Mars will require human sacrifice. And it's clear that Weston is willing to sacrifice almost anything, even to become a murderer, and including the murder of Ransom, in order to represent what he sees as the forward thrust of the onward movement, which he calls in Paralandra, using Bergson's term, the life force. And in a very telling moment in Paralandra, Weston calls that force into himself. And three times he uses, "I am," and he says something about himself being the center of that force. It's a parody of the words God used to describe himself. "I am, I am, I am, I am who I am." And it's at that moment that Weston disappears as a human being and becomes possessed. And from there on, Ransom refers to him as the unman. He has lost his humanity. And that's what Lewis meant, of course, by the term the abolition of man, the abolition of humanity, by seeking to control nature and superimpose our own agenda, we end up destroying our own humanity. This book, C.S. Lewis on the Final Frontier, Science and the Supernatural, the Space Trilogy, Oxford University Press release I mentioned earlier, is completely about that evolutionary agenda in those three books, showing how Lewis rejects them and puts in its place the plan God has for something far more wonderful. I'd like to end with a quote from Lewis in The Funeral of a Great Myth, because it suggests the spirit in which Lewis urges us to approach those who believe even in evolutionism, though he rejected it. I think this passage is full of grace, and it's a model for how Christians should treat each other over differences about this issue. It's from the conclusion of The Funeral of a Great Myth. Modern politics would be impossible without the myth of progress. Great parties to the political left and to the political right have a vested interest in maintaining the myth. In Russia, where it has been built into the state religion, it may survive for centuries. For it has great allies, its friends are propaganda, party cries, and bilge, and man's incorrigible mind. But that is not the note on which I wish to end. Still Lewis, all the way to the end now. The myth has all these discreditable allies, but we should be far astray if we thought it had no others. As I have tried to show, it has better allies too. It appeals to the same innocent and permanent needs in us which welcome Jack the Giant Killer. It gives us almost everything the imagination craves. Irony, heroism, vastness, unity and complexity, and a tragic close. It appeals to every part of me except my reason. That is why those of us who feel that the myth is already dead for us must not make the mistake of trying to debunk it in the wrong way. We must not fancy that we are securing the modern world from something grim and dry, something that starves the soul. The contrary is the truth. It is our painful duty to wake the world from an enchantment. The real universe is probably in many respects less poetical, certainly less tidy and unified than they had supposed. Man's role in it is less heroic. The danger that really hangs over him is perhaps entirely lacking in true tragic dignity. It is only in the last resort, and after all lesser poetries have been renounced and the imagination sternly subjected to intellect, that we shall be able to offer them any compensation for what we intend to take away from them. That is why, in the meantime, we must treat the myth with respect. It was all, on a certain level, nonsense. But a man would be a dull dog if he could not feel the thrill and charm of it. For my own part, though I believe it no longer, I shall always enjoy it as I enjoy other myths. I shall keep my caveman where I keep Balder and Helen and the Argonauts, and there often revisit him. I'm done.
So we have some time for questions. Anybody like to lead?
Okay. Is that view of progress also a view in China today?
Yes. Evolutionism, as Lewis defined it, is state-approved dogma, and it's part of the rationale. So religion is superstition, and this is science, and science will lead us where we need to go. That's very much mainstream Chinese view in higher education. See, it's also officially atheistic, so it suits the purpose to have an explanation that leaves God out of the equation.
Kind of fascinated with historical moments. You're saying in the 1920s, and he was fairly young, is when some of the first criticisms of this myth of progress were taking place. I got that right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm remembering my chronology, this is just before the modern synthesis in biology, because what was Darwinism before was really more Lamarckianism, which is teleological and has a hierarchy and fits in notions of progress. And then by the early 1930s, you've got more natural selection married to Mendelian genetics, and which is technically non-teleological, although people struggle with that. Was Lewis aware of that change in the science itself?
I'm not sure of the specific question. He did have around 36 books on this kind of science in his library that now are in the Wade Center, and he marked up a lot of them. That's a good question to ask, to read through Lewis's stuff and see if he has an awareness of it. I have not run across any specific mention of that.
Thanks so much, Wade, for everything. This is a fascinating talk to Dave. I want to ask your opinion about a particular passage in the book Out of the Silent Planet that I've often reflected on, and I'll get a lot of it wrong, I'm sure, as I try to recount it, but it always seems to me like it's a bit of Lewis saying some things that go against some modern opponents of the evolutionary view. So one of the things you often hear is that God created a very good world, therefore death was not a possibility in that good world, and that means evolution could never proceed. There's a passage in Out of the Silent Planet, and like I say, it's been a long time since I read it, and I'll get a lot of this wrong, but there's these beaver-like creatures that are not quite human.
The Rasa. There are three rational creatures, and the ones Lewis interacts with most are those beaver-like, seal-like creatures who are slightly taller than a human being.
And they are, they have not fallen, right? They are not even, they don't even have
the... And they have the Hanakraha.
And they go hunting for the Hanakraha.
Yeah.
And there's this interaction between one of these creatures and Ransom where he tells Ransom why it's a good thing that the Hanakraha is hunted and gives its life and dies boundlessly. And I've always thought, that just sounds to me like a good biological and philosophical marriage of the idea that death is not exclusively out of bounds for a good creation. What do you think about that?
Lewis thought, when he comments in his prose on this, that death came as a result of a fall. He says about the Hanakraha that it's not one of the rational creatures, so to hunt it would be, I don't know, maybe the equivalent of hunting a deer. In the Chronicles of Narnia, the children go hunting the stag, the end of one of the books. So it seems to give a point to life, knowing that it's going to end, but the Oyarsa of Malakandra, who's the reigning angelic type figure in Out of the Silent Planet, tells Ransom that his creatures have no fear of death. They welcome it. And they know not only that they will die, but they also know that the worlds will all die. And that doesn't bother them because they know that they're in the hands of Malaldil, of God, of Christ, and that he will use that to effect the next big step of transition in their real development. So it's certainly there. It's the sign of one of the highest signs of nobility in the society to kill the Hanakraha. And it doesn't seem to bother Lewis. Though, and I'm thinking there's this odd, what could be a contradiction. He has an essay called Vivisection. And in this essay, you may know it, he's opposed to vivisection, to using animals for experimentation. And that's because it's for some human good. It serves no good for the animal's part. And I know it seems a little bit of a contradiction to me to hold those two views. But you're exactly right. That's the climactic part of the book, killing the Hanakraha.
Other questions?
I don't really know how to ask this.
Probably will not answer it either, so go ahead.
The church tradition that I grew up in would dismisses evolution based on a chronology of death. And Lewis would respond to something like that by saying, you're not even asking the right question yet.
I think you're
This leads me, if you have any thoughts about that that would get me excommunicated from someplace else.
I don't know. May all be excommunicated at the end of the evening or something, but being excommunicated isn't the worst fate if it's just a human institution. So, at the end of Paralandra, something that goes to the time and space question, there is a series of doxologies. They all begin with blessed be he. There are 20 of them all together. And Lewis says in the preface to The Problem of Pain that there are three reasons why he was an atheist. He gave in support of his atheism. And one is so much waste time, so much waste space, so much coldness and emptiness. How could there be a good and creative God with so much cosmic nothingness? And the last of these blessings in praise of God I think this is the one, it's on page 218 of Paralandra, perhaps a volume that looks like this. Yet this is also the end and final cause for which he spreads out time so long and heaven so deep. Lest if we never meet the dark, never met the dark, and the road that leads nowhither, and the question to which no answer is imaginable, we should have in our minds no likeness of the abyss of the Father, into which, if a creature drop down his thoughts forever, he shall hear no echo return to him. Blessed, blessed, blessed be he. So Lewis has a complete change of mind about vast expanses of time and space, and he comes to see them as, among other things, a metaphor for the abyss, which is God. And scriptures are full of analogies from nature to God and what we can know about him. And Lewis would say that's one of the ways, it's the vastness of time and space. So it didn't bother him in the end. Is that to the point of what you were asking?
I would say yes. It was more so than your response was more so than what I was asking.
Or other so, anyway. Thank you.
Two questions. If C.S. Lewis put such a heavy emphasis on the fall, then we know that in the process of evolution, the death preceded the fall, preceded mankind by a good amount of time. What does he make of it?
I don't know if there's a fulsome answer to that, but he, in a passage I read, he is willing to grant that common descent up to the point that consciousness and reason and the ability to worship God comes, and that he sees as a supernatural imposition on whatever organism God was preparing. And so he's willing to say that could have taken a long period of time, could have gone through many permutations preparing the organism, but at some point there was something that came in from the outside. And it may well be the case that death of that image bearer of God entered with the fall. The fall from the image bearer of God, not the earlier organisms that were under development. But I think that's why he would say that.
So, in a sense, in light of your closing remarks, one of the reasons that Lewis could hesitate on writing a preface for a scientist would be lack of clear conviction on the science part of
it. I think he had convictions on evolutionism as an explanation for everything, the origin of life and destiny, from nothing existing to something coming into existence, or what purpose it might fulfill. But there's still death in that picture. And it's hard to escape. Lewis would say, those things that died did not have consciousness in the same way we do. That's no excuse for us killing them, as he would say in his essay, the section, that it was still there. It was not directed by human beings for human purposes that are on them selfish.
And the second kind of general question, the impression you give is that he was clearly aware of, even pre-Hubble, of a vast universe.
Mm-hmm. You would say the medievals were aware of that too.
And ancient. So in that sense, he was prepared to believe in, quote unquote, believe in evolution. But his problem then was not the scientific process of how the periodic table develops or how we arrive on the scene, but a bigger metaphysical understanding of what.
I think that's accurate. I think he would have been thrilled to discover that, do I get this right, fluorine gas is produced in white dwarf stars and in no place else, and then it's disseminated through the universe, if that's an accurate fact. I think those kinds of things would have fascinated him, and it would have contributed to the way glorifies God, for the complexity he has created. And I think he would have found ample ways to accommodate his Christian beliefs to the movement of scientists. It's the large scale making of meaning out of something that he objects to from within the system, knowing that it has to come, in his view, from outside the system.
Did he write anything about the Big Bang or cosmic evolution, the development of the inorganic universe?
Does he say anything about it?
Right.
Not that I'm aware of. He implies the development from, he speaks of development from inorganic to organic, so he's certainly aware of that. Of that concept.
Okay.
But in the way you asked the question, I'm not sure he asked it in the same way.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
He might have if he had lived into our generation.
Mm-hmm. So, my question is kind of twofold. The first part is in C.S. Lewis's view of the organism to the state of. Does he then, if other organisms that are okay by God because they're lack of consciousness, what sees him is he seen them as more robotic, like from a false perspective?
Probably not robotic, but he made a big distinction in the lack of consciousness or reason between ourselves and the animals, and in what we would call spirit. Even I think the psychological components, the ability to have emotion, to have wonder,
to have longing. This is the thing that appealed to Lewis so much, and in the myth of progress is it speaks to our longing. We want something bigger, fuller, to be part of something grand and expansive and durable. And his character, Weston, who is an evolutionist, I think was transported by that myth. I am the cutting edge of that I myself. So I think he made a big distinction between animals and humans. I don't know if that would satisfy the issue of death ultimately. That might help a little.
That was the second part of the question that was regarding death and the progression of organisms, human insights. So what C.S. Lewis would see the purpose of death for organisms before the creation of man.
No. I guess you could say, what would be the purpose of having so many humans, or what would be the purpose of having human history of a certain length? That's the kind of question we don't know the answer to, and he would call the attempt to answer that historicism. We don't know where we are in the grand scheme of things. There are many things we don't know about God's purposes. What will he do with us when we no longer inhabit the world as we know it? I don't think we know the answers to that yet. I've sometimes thought that one of the fun things about heaven is I could get all my questions answered. But I've learned from Lewis that that's not likely to happen, and it's very easy to see why. If God is infinite and I am finite, he's the creator and I am the creature, I will never get to the end of him. There will always be more questions about God and about his purposes. And I think one of the glories of anticipating heaven is that sense of dynamism. That's not done. We're just getting started. As he says in the last battle, you know, after God takes the human characters home, that is the beginning of the first chapter. That never has an end. So I think there are reasons for everything God does. And I think it includes his glory. And beyond that, we'll learn together.
Time for another question.
He's allowing for common descent, it's still a type of evolution. Would you call that guided evolution?
I'm sorry, would you say the first part again? I didn't quite hear.
Common descent is still a form of evolution.
Yes.
So do you call that a guided evolution, or God is manipulating each change?
Yeah, you would think that God was behind all of it. That nothing happens apart from him, that it's not accidental or random, even though it may appear that way to us, not knowing what he's up to, and God guided. So he's not completely on board with common descent, but he's willing to grant it, and he doesn't make it an article of faith. He would believe God guides him.
I think Michael Behe thinks that way too. He's written books about why evolution can't happen, and he still thinks that there's common descent.
Yeah. He takes a long time. That's good.
Oh, one more. We can do one more quickly.
I suppose I'm going to push it a little bit on this, as to what Lewis thinks is happening. I'm frequently troubled by sermons, because pastors end up quoting passages in the Bible where the image that is used of God taking his leg, shaping the creatures, well, we know that that's not the way it happens. So, what would you call? I mean, you just spoke here in answer that God guided. But it seems to me that those of us who are alive today and are trying to think theologically actually have a serious challenge. What does it mean to be, to believe in a God who created with moving parts? And was in no hurry to get to the end. And we know we're not at the end. But I mean, we're farther along than things were 13 billion years ago. What do you think he would be saying in light of his concerns about evolution, of his acceptance of evolution? What do you think he would be saying to evangelical Christians today about, okay, folks, let's get serious and let's do some better theology?
He would say that the complexity is not a problem, that the complexity is part of the glory of God. Is that your question?
I think that's part of it, but I wouldn't be satisfied with just saying, well, complexity is part of the glory of God. We would have to be able to, in some way, address how that complexity works itself out.
I think you would be comfortable saying that's the job of the scientist, and it's the job of the Christian who's a scientist to show how that fits in. He says as much about vocations and Christians and mere Christianity, that it's the role of Christians in various areas to show how their faith applies to that. And I think he would applaud the effort of an organization like this, and the thinkers who do, to try to make that case and to incorporate new understandings in science into the way we understand the scriptures. He would not have begun to make the claim that he was the last word on that. It's the big picture philosophical things that I think he felt comfortable enough to address, but not the kind of inner work question that you're asking. You'd say, that's not my job, that's your job, because you're a scientist.
Ready. I would like to invite you to continue the conversation. We have refreshments that are upstairs. If you just go up.
Oh, no, they're in the Mastodon.
Oh, no, actually, they're in the Mastodon room. Oh, this is a special night then, because we normally don't get in there. So go around and into the Mastodon room to find refreshments, and we'll continue to talk there. And let's thank Wayne for coming.